Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in this segment, we're going to begin a series about the O.J. Simpson case, a case which had a great deal of journalistic coverage, and yet which appears to have been of a nature that many of the most important facts simply got buried. This simply, the O.J. Simpson case, that is, simply did not receive the attention due it. In a recently concluded series entitled Specialized Knowledge and Abilities, I went into the tactic worldwide of Nazi and white supremacist groups of infiltrating the police and military in order to acquire the, quote, specialized knowledge and abilities, unquote, necessary for the formal overthrow of the state. And it appears that those efforts are being aided and abetted by Nazi and fascist elements inside of those very same states that are targeted for overthrow. This is an historical precedent that begins with Nazi, or this is a phenomenon with historical precedents that begin with Weimar Germany, in which the elements that were ultimately to coalesce into the Third Reich were hard at work in Weimar Germany through a combination of agitprop and assassination to subvert the Weimar Republic. This specialized knowledge and ability tactic appears to be employed not only in the United States but in Europe as well, and beyond that, the Nazi and fascist elements engaged in such activity in not only Europe but the United States appear to be in contact with each other as well as with Nazi and fascist elements within their respective governments. There is very disturbing evidence that, in point of fact, O.J. Simpson was framed for the murders of Ron Goldman and Nicole Simpson, and the media has not properly recorded the course of events, and indeed, neither the prosecution nor O.J. Simpson's defense team appears to have done all that was possible in order to clear O.J. Simpson or properly investigate the case. My own suspicions, and this will perhaps appear preposterous to some members of the listening audience, is that the O.J. Simpson case was in fact a domestic intelligence operation intended to do a number of things, including distract people from the contract with America, or contract on America, as I call it, to polarize the races, to dissuade people from turning out in the off-year elections in 1994. In fact, in California, where I do these programs, the Secretary of State was worried about the effect of the O.J. Simpson case on the off-year elections that brought Newt Gingrich and his contingent to power in both houses of Congress. There is a recent book entitled Legacy of Deception, subtitled An Investigation of Mark Furman and Racism in the LAPD. The book is authored by Stephen Singular, S-I-N-G-U-L-A-R, and was published in softcover by Dove Audio Incorporated. Copyright 1995. The ISBN number, by the way, is 0-7871-0863-4. Dove Books can be contacted at 301 North Canyon Drive, C-A-N-O-N, in Beverly Hills, 90210. And it's distributed by Penguin Books, USA. Stephen Singular, the author of this book, has previously written about the influence of neo-Nazis. He is described on the jacket flap of the book, or on the back cover, I should say. Again, this is a soft cover edition. Stephen Singular is a Denver-based journalist whose first book, Talk to Death, The Life and Murder of Alan Berg, became the basis for the 1989 Oliver Stone film Talk Radio. His previous books include the New York Times bestseller A Killing in the Family and Charmed to Death. The back cover of the book reads as follows. In the early hours of investigating the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Lyle Goldman, LAPD homicide detective Mark Furman uncovered evidence destined to become the cornerstone of the prosecution's case in the trial of O.J. Simpson. But as the elaborate legal epic unfolded, Furman himself, his character and professional conduct, far overshadowed the impact of his evidence. What emerged in the public eye, though shielded from the eyes of the jurors, was an appalling history of planting evidence, beating up suspects, virulent racism and anti-Semitism acted out behind the safety of a badge. It should be added that as far as I know, there has been no formal evidentiary finding of these types of activities on Furman's part. He certainly did brag about these types of things in his discussions with his recordings that he made over a number of years. Those recordings, of course, became altogether famous during the course of the trial. Again, as far as I know, there has been no overt finding of fact with regard to these apparent activities. Continuing with the back cover, while the defense attempted to capitalize on the heavily publicized information about Furman, prosecutors scrambled to maintain courtroom focus on the actual defendant. Meanwhile, journalist Steven Singular took on the task of infiltrating the police department crime lab in search of the truth. What he discovered earned him a starring role on the glittery defense team as he outlined for them a means of proving that the defendant's blood actually could have been planted at the crime scene. With this demonstration as a springboard, the defense scored a victory that astonished the entire world. But had a renegade cop actually planted the blood, or not? In Legacy of Deception, Steven Singular disassembles the wall of deception constructed by the LAPD to reveal a scenario far more sinister than anything that emerged in the course of the trial, chilling proof that true innocence was rare, of the trial, excuse me, chilling proof that true innocence was rare or non-existent in this nightmarish case. The preface to the book begins, and by the way, it has never been proved in a formal legal sense that Mark Furman or anybody else planted evidence. However, there was conclusive evidence that somebody, in all probability Furman, among others, planted evidence, and that this evidence planting and fabrication went from some of the police involved in the case right on up through the through some of the people in the crime lab, and there are indications that not only the prosecution, but even some members of the defense deliberately looked the other way with regard to this information. Beyond that, Steven Singular, in this remarkable, though largely overlooked book, accessed information from an anonymous source highly placed within the Los Angeles legal system. This source informed Furman about the various aspects of the case and how O.J. Simpson had, in fact, been framed. And O.J. Simpson was definitely framed. Beyond that, there are indications that Nazi elements, so-called neo-Nazi elements within the L.A. legal system were responsible for the framing. And again, I think this series should be taken in conjunction with the recently concluded Specialized Knowledge and Ability series. The preface to the book begins as follows. Actually, the preface to the book reads as follows. Our first meeting took place in Denver one hot afternoon in August of 1994, and the conversation left me feeling put off and stunned. The information I'd been given about the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Lyle Goldman was too inflammatory for my taste, and I don't like conspiracy theories. They're difficult to substantiate and often generate more confusion than clarity. But this individual wasn't talking about a conspiracy or a theory. He was talking about hard physical evidence and scientific facts, about objects that could be located, and a test that could be run in a laboratory. If these details were accurate, they had the power to free O.J. Simpson, who had been charged with committing these murders, and to uncover the greatest scandal in the history of the Los Angeles Police Department. If they were inaccurate, there could be trouble. I'd been told precisely how and why Detective Mark Furman had planted evidence against Simpson. I'd been told what the legal system had done in response to Furman's actions, and how the media and the American public had been terribly misled. My initial meeting with my source lasted about 30 minutes. On later occasions, I would be told many other things. The most disturbing piece of information concerned the first book I'd written, Talk to Death, The Life and Murder of Alan Berg. This book, which became the basis of Oliver Stone's 1988 movie Talk Radio, chronicled the assassination of a talk show host in Denver by a small band of neo-Nazis from Washington State. The killers were members of a fringe group known as The Order, who had decided to start a white power revolution by murdering Jews, African Americans, and other minorities. Their first Jewish target, gunned down in June of 1984, was Berg. Now, in the fall of 1994, I was being told that neo-Nazis were no longer operating just on the edges of American society, but had moved much closer to the mainstream. In some cases, they were inside the system itself and had become deeply disruptive. Initially, I had difficulty seeing how any of this was connected to the O.J. Simpson case. Why was I being given information about a double homicide that had occurred several states away from my home in Denver? And what was I, a total outsider to the Los Angeles legal system, supposed to do with all this? For months, almost nothing made sense. In among the very first pages of the book, there is a discussion of one of Steven Singular's many conversations with his anonymous but obviously highly placed source within the Los Angeles legal system. And I think many of the aspects of the case, from a legal and political as well as sociological standpoint, are summed up and expressed very concisely in the following exchange. Quote, and this is quoting Singular's source, This isn't just about O.J. Simpson and a double murder, he'd said. This is about the fragility of our legal system. This is about the power of the media and how a few well-chosen words or images can manipulate the perceptions of 200 million people. We live in a society where the presumption of innocence is supposed to be a guaranteed right. No one can exercise that right when the media run opinion polls on a man's guilt or innocence and then report that two-thirds of the citizens believe he's guilty before a jury had been selected and the trial had even begun. What if their opinions are based not on facts, but on assumptions that have no connection at all with reality? In this case, one detective jumped to a conclusion and did something very wrong. He ignored what his job really is, to investigate every possible lead, and then he convinced three other policemen to do the same thing. They disregarded their duty to society, which is to scour the crime scene and collect all the evidence while it is still fresh. Their behavior set off a chain reaction that no one could stop. The people in authority in L.A.'s legal system immediately decided who the killer had to be. The authorities told the media they had a suspect. The media ran with the story, despite the fact that they had no real evidence to substantiate anything. The media also threw away Simpson's presumption of innocence, which they proclaimed to hold so dear. The public began believing what the media were saying as if it were the truth. Things are out of control. This case concerns more than the death of two people. It's about the erosion of our legal system and our constitutional rights. Read the Bill of Rights. See how many of Simpson's rights have already been violated. These things are not written in stone. They can be damaged or destroyed. People need to know that. We've lost our ability to distinguish between what is serious business and what is televised entertainment. By the way, I would interject, Edith Wharton, the famous American author, had a quote. There's a quote of Edith Wharton that I think applies not only to the United States as a whole in 1996, but also to the O.J. Simpson case in particular. Edith Wharton observed that a frivolous society can only achieve dramatic significance through what its frivolity destroys. And I think that applies to the O.J. Simpson case. Continuing with this exchange between Stephen Singular and his legal source, "Why don't you step forward and say all these things?" I'd asked him. "You know far more about the legal system than I ever will." "I can't." "Why not?" "I would lose my job and my career." You've got to understand that everyone involved in this case is first and foremost concerned not with the truth, but with protecting and advancing his or her professional position. The system is not about justice. It's about winning. Indeed, I would agree with that, and I'm afraid that the emphasis in the O.J. Simpson case was most assuredly on winning rather than justice. And indeed, there appeared to have been, at least according to Stephen Singular's source, some neo-Nazi elements inside of the Los Angeles Police Department that were involved with the framing of O.J. Simpson. I would note that there has been a documented history of some white supremacist groups penetrating LAPD. There was quite a bit of publicity some years back about a group called the Vikings, apparently a white supremacist group within LAPD. There is no hard discussion in this book of any particular groups. Newsweek magazine's issue from the last week of 1995 noted allegations from fellow officers of Mark Furman's contained within LAPD personnel files, the files that Judge Ito, by the way, would not allow to be introduced into evidence, that Furman was the de facto head of a white supremacist group within the Los Angeles Police Department entitled WASP, or White Anglo-Saxon Policemen. Again, those allegations by fellow officers, they were not permitted to be introduced into evidence by Judge Ito. I would also note that the Coalition for Human Dignity, a group in Portland, Oregon, and in Seattle, Washington, that combats fascist and white supremacist activities, has developed information that in the Sandpoint, Idaho area that Mark Furman moved to, there is very active white supremacist and Aryan Nations activity. Louis Beam, the author of the Leaderless Resistance Strategy, among other Aryan Nations Jones Related Elements apparently holds owns quite a bit of property in Sandpoint. There is also an Identity Christian congregation in Sandpoint, headed up by a fellow named Dave Barwell, according to the Coalition for Human Dignity. Again, they're based in Portland, Oregon, as well as in Seattle. The Searchlight magazine in the fall of 1995 had presented that information. I have not got those two sources in front of me, or I would quote them verbatim. We're going to touch again on some of the apparent Nazi activity in the Sandpoint, Idaho area. Furman moved to Sandpoint, a town of only 5,200. This is not to say that all or even most people in Sandpoint are white supremacists. I don't want to be misunderstood on that score. Returning again to Legacy of Deception and some of the information and observations provided to Stephen Singular by his source. And again, one of the reasons that his source approached Stephen Singular was because of his work on the Order and their assassination of Alan Berg. "Do you remember what you wrote about in your first book?" unquote. I thought back a decade earlier when I'd begun doing research on Talked to Death. Quote, "There are elements in the Los Angeles Police Department," he said, "that resemble some of the people you wrote about in that book," unquote. "You mean there are police officers with belief systems that aren't very different from the folks who murdered Berg. Racist, anti-Semitic, full of anger and hatred. They are deeply destructive to our legal system. Today, some of these people are wearing very respectable faces. I'm not saying that they're card-carrying members of an organization, but they have an attitude of us versus them that does not belong in law enforcement. They need to be exposed," unquote. Again, bear in mind the specialized knowledge and abilities tactic that I set forth in that eight-part series by the same name. Still later in Legacy of Deception, Stephen Singular's source discusses still further the implications of having individuals of this orientation within the legal system. "Go back to your first book," he said, "about the neo-Nazi killing of Alan Berg. The extremist movement you were writing about 10 years ago is still out there, but now it's a little different than it was a decade ago. What do you mean? In some ways, it's become more acceptable and widespread. I see it in those kill doctors at abortion clinics. I see it in those who kill doctors at abortion clinics." Excuse me, that was an unfortunate slip. Again, let me begin again with these two statements. "In some ways, it's become more acceptable and widespread. I see it in those who kill doctors at abortion clinics. I hear it on right-wing talk shows. A number of little dictators like to get up on their soapboxes and spew their hatred and intolerance. I see these things inside law. I see these things in law enforcement and other government institutions. It's inside the system now," unquote. Again, interjecting specialized knowledge and abilities. Returning to the text. "How many people are you talking about who work in law enforcement at the LAPD? Didn't writing the Berg book teach you that a very small group of people can be highly destructive? The Simpson case will reveal in graphic terms where this kind of thinking is leading us. It will demonstrate what happens to a society that is terribly afraid and believes that it must have all the answers right now, regardless of whose rights are trampled on, or who gets hurt. It will show us how easy it is to manipulate people through the power of the media. It will reveal very ugly things about race and racism, and it will show that we're living with a new kind of mob rule," unquote. And later, while the O.J. Simpson case was going on, the Oklahoma City bombing took place, and this occasioned the following train of thought on the part of Stephen Singular. "At 7:15 a.m. on February 2nd, my wife was in the kitchen making breakfast." Actually, this was not, I should say, the Oklahoma City bombing, but rather the information that Mark Furman had moved to Sandpoint, Idaho. "At 7:15 a.m. on February 2nd, my wife was in the kitchen making breakfast for our son and watching the TV show Good Morning America. She heard a report that Mark Furman had recently purchased property in the town of Sandpoint, Idaho. When she came upstairs and told me this a few minutes later, I was startled. I got a copy of Talk to Death and opened it to the later chapters. On page 244 was a reference to land owned by Gary Yarborough, a convicted neo-Nazi who had been connected to the men who'd assassinated Alan Berg. Yarborough's rented land was on Pack River Road, roughly 10 miles north of Sandpoint. For years, the area around Sandpoint had been known as an enclave for white supremacists and others who were loosely associated with the neo-Nazi movement. the Order, the most violent group who had emerged from this movement, had counterfeited money, stolen more than $4 million in armed robberies, and been responsible for the deaths of Berg and several other people. The Order had been inspired by the Turner Diaries, a blood-drenched fictional account of the overthrow of the American government by a small secret band of white supremacists also known as the Order. The novel was written by William Pierce, a physicist who published the book under the name of Andrew MacDonald, and it proceeded to become an underground classic of the neo-Nazi movement. The Order, both in the book and in reality, believed that Northern Europeans were the true, quote, chosen people of the Bible, unquote, while African Americans were subhuman, quote, mud people, unquote, and Jews were the, quote, spawn of Satan, unquote. Women and Hispanics were looked upon no more favorably, and nothing disturbed the members of the Order more than black men dating or marrying white women. Nicole Brown Simpson was the very image of the blonde female that men in the neo-Nazi movement regarded as a goddess and the mother of their race. She personified the kind of woman white supremacists want to keep away from black men. In my earlier research into the movement, I'd met a number of men who'd spoken bitterly about white women who dated black men and about how neo-Nazis viewed this as a betrayal of their race. No fear runs deeper in the heart of a white supremacist than the sexual fear of African-American males. Berg had been gunned down as a kind of first step in carrying out what the novel called the Day of the Rope, a slang term for the time when there would be a wholesale slaughter of Jews and blacks. On October 18, 1984, 4 months to the day after the talk show host was killed, FBI agents entered Gary Yarborough's home. The agents canvassed the entire residence, I had written and talked to death, before going upstairs and bending low to get through a doorway leading into a small space. Crossing the threshold, they came eyeball to eyeball with a 3-foot-high portrait of Adolf Hitler, surrounded by black crepe paper and candles. In other parts of the house, they found neo-Nazi literature, instructions for how the Order was to operate, code names for everyone in the group, 2 12-gauge shotguns, a bolt-action rifle, a .45-caliber Colt pistol, 5 semi-automatic rifles, a Winchester .22-caliber rifle, a .308-caliber Mac-10 machine pistol with a silencer, 106 of dynamite, 1.5 pounds of C4 plastic explosives, grenades, night vision scopes, more than 6,000 rounds of ammunition, bandoliers loaded with .308-caliber ammunition, 4 loaded crossbows, 110 blasting caps, police scanners, and booby traps. They found one other gun, a .45-caliber Mac-10 machine pistol and silencer that would be sent to Washington, D.C. for examination by ballistics experts. After extensive testing, they determined it was the gun Andrew Barnhill had purchased from Randall Rader in May for $500, the one given to Bruce Pierce for target practice near Troy, Montana, the one that killed Alan Berg. On February 2, 1995, Good Morning America reported that Sandpoint, Idaho, had become something of a retirement center for certain members of the LAPD, including Mark Furman. After hearing this, I called my source and asked if this was the connection he'd spent the past several months trying to help me make between the Simpson case and my first book. "Yes," he said. "Now do you see why I called you last summer? You're telling me that a neo-Nazi faction exists inside the LAPD. I'm telling you that an attitude exists and is allowed to exist because of the code of silence you find among police officers. Cops close their ears and look in the other direction. Does that really surprise you? No. Haven't you heard the statements that have been attributed to Detective Furman about him being utterly opposed to interracial marriages? Yes. And that he would arrest an interracial couple he saw riding in a car regardless of whether they were doing anything wrong or not? Yes. And you've heard reports that he's made disparaging remarks about Hispanics? Yes. And that he's been heard saying that he would like to burn all African-American citizens? Yes. How closely does that resemble the ideas and the desires of the people you wrote about in the Berg book? It's an exact parallel. If you were Furman, would you prefer to live in a big city where the population is multiracial and where many people hold your ideas in contempt? Or would you move to an isolated place, a safe haven where there were some who might regard you as a hero? I understand what you're saying. In some parts of Sandpoint, Idaho, the notion of moving a bloody glove in order to frame a black man is a great accomplishment, especially if that black man once had a white wife," unquote. He paused and then said, "Can't you see how one person who thinks he's doing something absolutely right is doing something that damages everyone? False assumptions kill people," unquote. "You're saying that O.J. is innocent, aren't you? Draw your own conclusions." In the next segment I'm going to read, and the concluding segment in this, the concluding passage in this segment, the author Stephen Singular notes that the Turner Diaries, which obviously inspired the Order, were the apparent inspiration for Timothy McVeigh's actions. Timothy McVeigh was allegedly involved in the Oklahoma City bombing. As I said in the Specialized Knowledge and Abilities segment, I have many questions about Oklahoma City. It would not surprise me if Timothy McVeigh was involved in some capacity. However, I think there is, in all probability, much more to the Oklahoma City bombing than just those two individuals. On a Wednesday morning, April 19th, as Dennis Fung's lengthy session on the witness stand was coming to an end, a bomb went off in front of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City. In the unspeakable aftermath of this explosion, at least 169 men, women, and children were found in the rubble caused by the blast. All were dead, and many were unidentifiable. It was the single largest act of terrorism ever launched against the United States and struck a blow to the nation's heart. It was unlike anything else that had ever happened in America. Across the country, people felt as if the wind had been knocked out of them, or they felt sick all over, or they ached deep inside. Why would anyone randomly kill government workers and small children? Since the Simpson case had begun 10 months earlier, no new event had been able to supersede it until now. The Oklahoma City bombing became the lead story on every news broadcast, and the extent of the tragedy dwarfed the Simpson trial. The initial speculation was that Middle Eastern terrorists might have set off the explosion. That idea prevailed for a couple of days until federal authorities began uncovering some linkages between right-wing militia movements around the nation and the disastrous FBI raid on a Waco, Texas religious compound exactly 2 years ago to the day, which had left both adults and children dead. As the FBI was investigating the Oklahoma City bombing, one young man gradually emerged as the leading suspect. Timothy McVeigh, an ex-soldier who'd been aligned with some of the militia movements, had been picked up by the police while driving away from Oklahoma City on the morning of the explosion. He was immediately taken into custody. When reporters started looking into McVeigh's background, the names of several right-wing extremists whom he'd been loosely associated with surfaced in the media. A few of these names had been mentioned in my book on the murder of Alan Berg, and some of the names could be traced back to the area around Sandpoint, Idaho, where Mark Furman had taken up residence since his recent retirement from the LAPD. In time, the FBI would learn that Timothy McVeigh had studied the Turner Diaries, the novel that had served as the blueprint for the crimes committed by the neo-Nazi group The Order back in the mid-1980s. McVeigh reportedly kept this book with him at all times and sold copies of it at gun shows. He was aware of the Aryan Nation Church in northern Idaho. He knew that the Order had sprung out of that church and that this small band of men had killed Berg. McVeigh was familiar with another section of the Turner Diaries, which put forth the notion of bombing a federal building around 9 in the morning as part of a revolution that would bring to power white males and eliminate Jews, African Americans, Hispanics, and other races. This bloody revolution, the Day of the Rope, may have commenced when the Murrah building was bombed. And indeed, I have made my feelings clear concerning Oklahoma City in the aforementioned Specialized Knowledge and Abilities series. We're going to continue with our analysis of Stephen Singular's book, Legacy of Deception, about the framing of O.J. Simpson, allegedly by Nazi-like elements within the Los Angeles Police Department, perhaps even explicitly Nazi elements within the legal L.A. legal system, I should say. However, that concludes this segment. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.